You're in luck. It's 5 minutes after 10 o'clock. It's a Thursday, not just any old Thursday, but the Thursday that Chris White and Matt McAuliffe are in the studio to enlighten us about church history. Now, we've been doing these programs really for a year and a half or so, and monthly times I look forward to find out more about people, places, things, events in church history. What happened in our spiritual family, and covered a lot of interesting topics in that year and a half, and gee, I hope it goes on for another year and a half or 10. Matt and Chris are back today, and the topic of discussion is, the topic itself, church history. Where does it come from? Why is it important, and how is it made, and what gets included, and that sort of thing? And so,
why bother?
Yeah, why bother? Church history. Well, I maintain that the answer to that question is it really is all designed by God anyway. And to find out about what God did, you know, he didn't stop when he talked to John in the island of Patmos. And God has been in charge of what's happening, and I think it's interesting to find out what he's doing. Huh?
Amen.
What
That's
he has
right,
done
Pat.
And what he's doing right now. So anyway, guys, kind of an interesting subject. Where in the world do you go to start on something like
well,
that?
Well, you know, Pat, I really think that probably one of the first things we ought to talk about is just the role of history, you know, its value to the Christian believer before we talk about really where we get our church history from. You know, history is in that category of information in our lives that if we were to give it a theological category, we call it part of general revelation. Mm-hmm. There's two kinds of revelation in the world today. There's what we know as special revelation, which is God's unique message to man that comes to us by the prophets and the apostles. But then there's also what we would call general revelation. And this is, we call it general because it's pretty much available to everybody, whether you're a believer or a non-believer. And in general revelation would be things such as nature and creation, would be mm-hmm. things that we've learned from the sciences, and history is certainly part of that. Granted, of course, through these things, you know, we don't know God perfectly or precisely like we do through special revelation. But on the other hand, we see that behind history there seems to be an invisible hand that is guiding history, and we can learn a lot about the purposes of God through history. So,
you know, guys,
it's part of that general revelation.
We should go to Washington, D.C. and start a Smithsonian Institute of Christian History. You know, we've got the Natural History Museum. And,
send in your nickels and dimes,
yes,
boys and girls.
We should do that.
Pat,
you know,
Daly.
As long as we have the Ella Fitzgerald wing as part of that
thing. Didn't she sing gospel songs somewhere?
She must have. She somewhere okay, we could okay. Do that.
Sorry to interrupt. Just thought of that, though. We don't have a museum or something like that we could go to.
Well, it is fun. It would be really fun to concentrate a bunch of stuff, you know, for Christian history. We often will go on the web and look at Christian History Magazine on the internet, and the Catholic Church has some good sources, and it really is fun to go puttering through the closet of not just human history, but to find out, peek behind the curtain, mm-hmm. find out what is the story behind all these names that we know, you know, Martin Luther and Eusebius and Joan of Arc, you know, what is the story with these people? And it's exciting. And not only that, we learn a lot, Pat. Honest to goodness, history is a thing. It has been said very realistically that those who forget history are condemned to repeat it, and that is completely the truth. People that have studied a little bit of history, especially church history, end up having a good deal of perspective. They're not as easily frightened by things that go mm-hmm. wrong. One of my favorite examples is, that horrible film, Last Temptation of Christ, that came out a few years ago. That was a bad film. I mean, just totally apart from its blasphemous content, it was not good as a film. I'm a film buff, and I kind of screened it after all the screaming went on, and it was terrible. If we had just left that alone and trusted God, it would have died in 2 or 3 weeks. Nobody would have gone to see it. But we live with our protest and our energy and our fear that something bad was happening to God because of this movie, and it stayed in the theaters for a couple of years because of that. It's just if you have studied history, you know that these things, what, Christopher, was it Gamaliel that said that about Peter and the apostles?
If it was, you know, if this is of man, it's going to die a thousand deaths, and if it's God, what are you going to do to get in the way of it?
Knowing history really allows you to do that with some confidence, because you've seen, well, God has handled this for 2,000 years and before with really no big requirement from human assistance. I don't know, but as Christopher pointed out, I mean, it is a minefield. It is. It's not an exact science. As a matter of fact, the whole study of history, how history comes about, how it's passed to us, is called historiography. And one of the chief ingredients of that is, how do we know? What are the sources of our information? Because that's the key crystal individual element of this that determines whether you're actually hearing about reality or you're just hearing somebody's story. Well, just for fun, some of the sources that we go to, whether it's a high school history book or Christian History Magazine or this program itself, are all based on these sources. The first I would call personal sources, which are some of your best. These are like journals, diaries, letters that have been written. The reason they're so good is because people are recording the information they believe to be true in a very unguarded style. You know, they're not trying to convince anybody of anything. They're just, well, this is what happened to me today. That's very valuable to us, and it's a huge source of information of historical content. Then you get into a little bit more dicey stuff. You have what are called political sources. These are like government documents, official documents, military reports. And they're supposed to be objective, and very often they are. But a lot of times, you know, some young lieutenant will submit a report and he wants to make himself look good, so he writes this and this and this. Or in a recent event in news, you'll get somebody submitting reports for the government and they falsify information so that it makes the spotted owl and the lynx look like they're endangered species, and they try to adjust things. So you really got to be careful with the government reports.
You know, one of the things that just an example of government reports and how it affects what we know about church history, a lot of what we know about the persecution of Christians came from letters going back and forth to Roman proconsuls and writing back and asking, you know, well, what do you mean by this policy of persecuting Christians? What should we do in this case and that case? And that would be an example of how we learn from that and how it informs us today. It's a very non-weighted piece of correspondence that we can peer into and get an idea of the extent of, like, the persecution of Christians.
And actually, even something that you wouldn't necessarily trust might contain good information. There are even what are called panegyrics, which are kind of their government-sponsored. The government will pay someone to write a report about it, and obviously this guy is going to make the government sound pretty good, or a given individual. And there's
like Virgil in the Aeneid.
And we'll talk about Eusebius and Constantine in that way. But there is good information there. You just need to be careful. You need to understand some of the motivations. Some of the other things we have are just social histories, commentaries, articles, old newspapers, even if they're cuneiform, essays, literature. Another big area is cultural, just some of the traditions, some of the lore, art, music. A lot of these things contain intrinsic information about the history of a people, the physical things that go on. In Bethlehem, if you go there today, you'll see the ladies wearing hats that kind of remind you of Rapunzel or Cinderella. And the reason is because the Crusaders brought their ladies, and they wore those hats. And to this day, there is pretty verifiable physical evidence of the Crusaders' presence there 1,000 years ago, is that these gals are still wearing the same headgear. It's just interesting, you know, the way Islam has changed the music of Spain and things like this, the onion domes of Russia indicating the Byzantine influence. There are physical artifacts, which actually brings us to archaeology, the last really good source of information, where we uncover physical ruins, cities, tablets, literature, statues, steles. These are things that especially recently have mounted to show an overwhelming authentication of biblical truth. It's because we're just getting so good in this science that we're actually accumulating a huge mountain of evidence to show that, yeah, the Bible, when it talks about a place, it was a real place. When it talks about a person, it was a real person. It's kind of fun to see this go on. All of this boils down to the fact that we need to be careful about the motivation behind the piece of information we're using to discover our history. And again, there are varying degrees. The worst is just straight propaganda. That's what Joseph Goebbels did for Adolf Hitler. That has no connection to reality. It's what the Stalinists did and the Russian communists. It's not supposed to be about reality. It's supposed to change your mind and brainwash you. Okay, well, that's pretty worthless as historical information. A step up from that would be what we call spin, agenda-driven information. I'm going to use a controversial example and say that if you really want to know what's going on between Israel and the Palestinians right now, probably Ted Turner is not the best guy to listen to. He's not going to give you a good... He has lied. CNN has told fabrications about this this conflict and conflicts before. You just need to know that so you are careful about the information you receive from that source. The media today generally leans in that direction, so you need to be careful about that. Now, one of the best ones is next level up is people who recognize their bias, and the best Christian historians that we'll talk about today did that. They realize, okay, I'm a Christian, I have a Christian worldview, obviously that's going to creep through. What they'll do is they'll actually warn you about that in their introductions in these sources. They'll actually try to compensate for that and bring in the other side of the coin, so to speak, and look at it in a different way. These are probably the most valuable sources of information. They're the closest we can come to reality. Probably the best you can get is the ideal, which is unattainable, and that's perfect, objective, literal truth. It's what journalism is supposed to be, but of course never is. So basically, between source and motivation behind the source, those are the two things we have to juggle and balance when we're considering both historians and sources of information.
So where does church history come from for us? You know, we get, of course, an example, really, of the first historian in the Bible, and that was Luke, who made very clear in the introduction to the book of Luke, the Gospel of Luke, and then also the book of Acts, you know, that it was his intention to set forth an orderly account of what happened. Luke used all sorts of interviews and sources. He was not alive when the events happened. And he kind of sets a pattern that is followed later on throughout the history of the church. The Gospels, typically, a lot of people consider those to be the historical books. And the Gospels themselves are books that talk about historical events. But those actually had a motivation behind each of them. And that was not really to give us pure, true history, but their motivation was to bring people to faith in Christ. They were unapologetically evangelistic pieces of history, and so history was written in such a way as to be compelling us to have faith in Christ. And yet, it refers to historic events, where the book of Luke and Acts moves more in the direction of what we would call classic history. But after Luke, probably one of the greatest persons that we are indebted to as Christians today for preserving the history of the church is a man by the name of Eusebius. Mm-hmm. And Eusebius is kind of an interesting guy. He lives at a time where he really bridges one era of church history all the way into the next.
They're still being persecuted, aren't they?
During his lifetime, after his conversion, Christians are undergoing persecutions. And time in his life, he's a budding scholar, studying under a man by the name of Pamphilius in Caesarea. And Pamphilius, which I wonder if we get the name pamphlet from him. I have no idea. It kind of struck me one day when I was thinking about this. Pamphilius was a man who was a scholar, Christian scholar, and he had as really his mission in life, though, preserving biblical manuscripts and some of the ancient theological writings of the church, or the writings of what we would call the church fathers. And Eusebius was his dutiful assistant, and so he had amassed this great library, and Eusebius knew all about it, knew all the contents of this library and everything. And then, lo and behold, Constantine the Great rises to power, the church becomes legalized in the Roman Empire, and Eusebius is also raised into leadership. As a matter of fact, he is a key player at the first church council that was called by Constantine. And as a matter of fact, Constantine wanted to elevate him to be one of the chief bishops of the entire world. And, you know, Eusebius kind of put his hand up and said, you know, no thanks for the honor. But he actually takes it upon himself during this period, latter period of his life, to write about and preserve for us what happened during the first 300 years of the church. And If it were not for that, outside of the Bible, we would literally have no knowledge whatsoever. Now, granted, Eusebius waxes eloquent about how wonderful Constantine is, what a great person he is. He is the one that the story about, you know, in this sign conquer, Eusebius is the person whom Constantine tells that to, and that's where that story comes from. And so, once again, as Matthew said, you have to read through sometimes and wade through. It gets a little thick, the glory of how wonderful Constantine was in this book. But we are indebted to Eusebius there because of the fact that so many documents that he refers to do not exist. And what we know that those documents actually are contained in his writings.
All the church fathers, Ignatius, Polycarp, Clement, we know about. We have some of their writings, but we know so little about them. It's because Eusebius recorded these guys. And totally in defense of Eusebius, quite frankly, when people say that it's kind of a panegyric and that he's really whitewashing Constantine and just doing this public relations job on Constantine, you know, the fact is you go from being a persecuted minority and a guy raises up, stops the persecution, puts peace in the empire, legalizes your church, found schools.
Stands up against heretics and unsound doctrine.
Okay, excuse me. I'm going to have a little gratitude for this guy.
no doubt. And also Eusebius made it very clear in his introduction to the book that he was interested in preserving knowledge for the future generations of Christians, that we would know the heritage and the legacy of the first three centuries or the ancient church era, which moves us on then to a later development, the Venerable Bede.
Boy, the Venerable Bede, which everyone has heard of, and very few people have much knowledge about this guy. He's just a wimpy little monk around the end of the 6th century on the east coast of the British Isles, right there where Scotland turns into England, actually just about 50 miles down the coast from Lindisfarne. Where the wonderful Gospels were done, one of the most spectacular pieces of art in the history of Western civilization. There was this whole cluster of missions, religious communities. This was the height of the classic Celtic spiritual movement in which all the books were rewritten and preserved. The scripts were coming over from a falling and decaying Europe and being preserved and rewritten by the Irish monks. Well, Bede was just this wimpy little guy sitting there on the coast. And what made him great is the fact that he simply studied the Word and studied this library, this incoming library of old ancient manuscripts. And what he did was he picked up kind of where Eusebius and Luke left off and wrote what is called the Ecclesiastical History of the English People. And basically, this was a continuation of the New Testament in form, content, and thrust. This was a look at British history in a coherent frame of reference designed to show God's hand in history. And people say that he used sources, inaccurate sources, and they question some of his scholarship for that reason. But the fact is that what he did was a huge and actually brilliantly done accomplishment in terms of history. It shaped the way histories were to be done for the next 1,500 years, because it was the first time Bede really embraced the idea of objectivity, trying to find out what really happened, and with the viewpoint of a man of God. But he was very interested in painting a true picture, and I pretty much succeeded in doing this.
Well, also, Bede has touched all of our lives in the sense that when we refer to this year being the year 2002 A.D., the A.D. dating system comes from the Venerable Bede.
Is that right?
Yes.
Now, he didn't develop it. It was developed by
Italian guy. Exigenius. Wasn't some Italian monk?
Yeah, a monk. Yeah. But Bede put it in his history, and that's why this year is 2002. Is because we're dating it because Bede stuck it in his history, and that just carried forward. And he just developed a plethora of commentaries and works and letters and essays. But we know him primarily for that
Ecclesiastical
history.
I'm going to have to read that, guys.
It's interesting. Well, the next guy we have to talk about, we're going to use him as an example because we're going to fast forward to the Reformation, and oh my goodness, all the emotion going on. And this is where we really see history can be used as a weapon, because in the Reformation, Reformation, there were competing histories. You know, as soon as the Protestants and Catholic scholars, you know, were at heads to heads, the Protestants would develop a history that made the Protestants look great and the Catholics look like scum, and mm-hmm. the Catholics would come back with exactly the reverse, and the saintly Catholics and then the Protestant scum. And these guys, they're just using history as a political weapon. And one of the better histories that we're going to talk about is by a man, was it John Fox? No, what's his first name?
Yeah, John Fox.
John Fox, that did the martyrology.
Fox's Book of Martyrs.
Basically, what happened here, Fox was actually a pleasant man. He was actually not given to violence, but he was so overwhelmed by, after King Henry VIII's death, he was so overwhelmed by the persecution sponsored by Queen Mary, the Bloody Mary of history, who really never killed more than about 300 people, but because of Fox, that he wrote this book, which was a wonderful history of the early martyrology of the Christian Church. I mean, it really is a great job. He really did a good job of outlining all the martyrs. It's why we know of Perpetua and
Felicitas.
They're just all of them. But one of the problems is, you'll notice for about 100 years or 200 years preceding the Reformation, you stop hearing about Catholic martyrs. They just ceased to exist. And basically, his take on it was just to update and use the martyring of the Protestants as a continuation of Christian history. Mm-hmm. And so just kind of blew over the Catholic martyrs that were involved. Basically, it's still a wonderful book. There are some updated versions that will take you even into the martyrdoms that are occurring today in Libya and China and Latin America. And so it's still a historically viable book, but it's not until we get to Philip Schaff.
I don't know if we have time to talk about Philip Schaff.
But I'm talking about Schaff.
Who's the man who won't cop out when there's history all about Schaff? Okay, maybe that was a bad one.
Just really quickly, Schaff was a 19th century Christian man, really brilliant scholar, and wrote a huge history. You've actually read that whole thing, haven't you?
You know, are you going to really shame me publicly?
You
that
are
I read?
So cool. I mean, when I grow up, I want to be like you.
What kind of nerd would read the entire 8 volumes of that, and I did. That's about it.
A lot of free time at work.
Philip Schaff was the first guy to really lift objectivity up and go out of his way to write a history that was its sole purpose, even though viewed as through the eyes of a man of God, was as exact a recording of physical reality as possible. He did a wonderful job of it. He was a real very devoted, a devout, ecumenical man, really about the unity of Christ and viewing history as the story of God's people. And it's even if we don't use that history today, it really shaped all the following histories. Latourette, F.F. Bruce, Shelley. I mean, all those guys pretty much did it. Oh, speak of the dangers.
You got about a minute. You know, there's a couple dangers, though, with church history that I thought we ought to close with today. One of them is just the uncritical reading of history. You know, once again, getting back to thinking, well, just mm-hmm. because it happened in the old days must be make it okay, mm-hmm. you know, and just accepting everything. Because, you know, the church had good ideas. They had bad ideas. They had beliefs that we need to hang on to, and some things, you know, definitely the belief in the resurrection. That was a good idea. Mm-hmm. But remembering and being careful about not reading it uncritically. But then the other danger, and probably the biggest one, is the whole idea of ignoring it altogether. You know, virtually every cult group today makes claims that they have a true understanding of Jesus, and yet invariably they have recycled the errors that the church addressed more than 1,500 years ago. I think it's just important for all of us as believers to recognize that we have a root system that goes back 2,000 years. And in learning those things, it frequently combats a lot of the fads and the next big things that are always coming out in the church today. So
I'll tell you what. Thank you, Matt. Chris, Christianity is couched in history. That's one of the things you can count on. Hey, In Touch is next with Charles Stanley. I'm Pat Daly. Lord bless you today. There's Lolly.